Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on why journalists use anonymous sourcing and leaked information. This is part of our July series on how the media works in these times of change. Today, why reporters use information that comes from anonymous or leaked sources and how you should regard that information. Remember that some of the most consequential stories in recent times, the Russian CIA hacking, the CIA rendition, black prison sites, domestic surveillance, are known because someone decided to leak information to the media, and most leakers don't want their names known. But also remember that for as much as White Houses and presidents excoriate leaking, they do it too. President Trump is tweeting this morning, "Remember, when you hear the words sources say from the fake media, oftentimes those sources are made up and do not exist." So today we'll talk about how you should assess leaked information in the news you consume. And here's something else to think about. Do you think journalists use too many anonymous sources? Do you treat a news story that contains leaked information with more skepticism than usual? Or are these revelations too important to worry about how they are getting out? So I want to talk about, as a news consumer, how you view stories that might cite a number of anonymous sources that are based on leaked information. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Dana Priest is with us. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post and a professor at the University of Maryland, and she's with us today from Washington. And Dana, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show.
Oh, great to be here.
Mei-Ling Hopgood is with us. She's an associate professor of journalism at the Medill School at Northwestern and with us from Evanston, Illinois. And Mei-Ling, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And investigative reporter Barton Gilman will join us a little later. Dana, I want to go right to what the president is tweeting today. Again, he says, "Remember, when you hear the words sources say from the fake media, oftentimes those sources are made up and do not exist." What should listeners and news consumers know about what the president is saying there?
Well, in my opinion, as a journalist who has used anonymous sources throughout my career, I do not think any of that is accurate. And if I could just back up a minute, I'm sure the use of anonymous sources infuriates readers. I mean, when I read a story, I want to know who's telling a journalist that story. But unfortunately, it's not really up to the journalist. All good experienced journalists would much rather be able to cite the person who is telling them information or the people who are giving them information, cite them by name. But it is the government's decision and the decision by the individuals who are speaking to reporters to withhold their name. It is not the journalist's choice. The journalist has to make this agreement, this kind of pact, that they will honor the confidentiality in exchange for information they couldn't get themselves without the sources. So that's particularly true in the White House. It's not just a Trump phenomenon. It's for every administration. And part of it is political. They just want the president to have the attention and don't want the underlings to, divert that attention. And that's on non-controversial issues. On controversial issues, sometimes an administration decides to cooperate with a reporter in order to get information out there, but not as an official statement by the government. Maybe it's a trial balloon on a certain kind of policy, or it's something controversial, and they really want the public to know that they're debating this seriously, but they don't want to stand up behind the podium and say, "Well, we haven't quite figured out our policy yet, but we're working a lot on it." So there are many reasons. And then, of course, the more controversial reason, or the reason that I think underlies the president's comments, is there are people who disagree with what is happening. And one of the ways they can express that disagreement without losing their job is to cooperate with reporters and tell them things that it's that are happening, that are sensitive, that are controversial, and sometimes that are classified. And so those are some of the many reasons that reporters need to are forced to use anonymous sources, and why the government actually uses anonymous sources.
All of that said, Mei-Ling, as Dana lays it out, newsrooms, journalists, their editors have to decide how they're going to use these anonymous sources and this leaked information, and the reporting that would go around that, right, to support this information that's being leaked or given as anonymous sources. Can you talk a bit about that?
Right. Professional organizations, great journalism organizations like the Washington Post, have standards that they set. I'm looking right now at the SPJ, the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. Many organizations have standards that are written that hold their journalists and their reporters to a high standard of sourcing. The SBJ Code of Ethics in particular, you know, number one on this on their ethics paper is identify sources whenever feasible and give the public as much information as possible on source reliability. And number two, be critical of sources' motives before promising anonymity and be very critical of that. So I think it's misleading to say that journalists are being unwieldy about their use of anonymous sources.
Mei-Ling, just let me add this. I think what happens, though, is what you've just read is not well understood, right, by
exactly.
News consumers at large. And perhaps you were about to say that when I interrupted. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. And I think there is a lot, because of how information is getting to people these days, they can easily pick up and copy and post sources and not check who's providing that information.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to pick up things that you kind of agree with or that seem controversial without taking a real look at what sources those are, what media sources actually, and what kind of standard they have for the work that they publish.
Pat says on Twitter, to follow exactly what you just said, I vet my news sources themselves. If they have a record of reliability, then I don't worry so much about it. Dave says, what I don't like is when journalists let a source go anonymous to say something completely innocuous, should be reserved for important reasons. Yeah, Dana, would you respond to that?
Well, I absolutely agree with both of those statements. And just to play devil's advocate or to play a reader rather than a journalist, this idea of how do you assess a journalist using anonymous sources? Well, you go to Google and you Google the journalist. And what is their record for journalism? You know, if someone is inaccurate all the time and we do run corrections, eventually they're going to be fired from the from news outlets. So actually, I did this little experiment just now. And Phil Ruckert and Ashley Parker have written a story on the Washington Post today. It's a very critical story of how the White House is under siege. And right in the very beginning, it quotes, according to top White House officials and outside advisors. So go to Phil Rucker on Google and see, and you'll see the length of his experience and how he has climbed through the Washington Post hierarchy from an intern to Metro to political reporter covering the Romney campaign. You know, eventually now he's a part of the White House press corps. And so you can see his credentials. On the other hand, if you go to a website that I would call not a traditional mainstream website and or news organization, and there are many. So I just went to Breitbart as an example and looked at one of the Penny Starr. She's a named reporter there. So I looked up her name. She has been for 6 years a features editor at something called the Island Packet, and a biography of her. Or a story about her calls her a conservative advocate. So I'm not going to opine on whether she is you know, a good journalist or not, but I'm saying as an outsider, you have the ability to look at a reporter's credentials and then to judge how you're going to see their use of anonymous sources in that context, which I think is, we try to be transparent. I think we're not as transparent about our process and our as we could be, but we are transparent about our people, and
yeah.
we do have standards that in the newsroom they must, you know, they live by.
Yeah, and this is what this show is about, to try to understand the way newsrooms and journalists think about the use of anonymous sources and leaked information. And then for you as news consumers, what else do you want to know about that process in a newsroom? And do you have a tendency to look with more skepticism, which is just fine? How do you regard stories that are using a lot of anonymous sources and leaked information? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and to Lee in Minneapolis. Hi, Lee.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was just calling in, just had a quick comment. Just as someone who takes in a lot of news information media, I look at the way that I understand reporters have to use anonymous sources. It makes complete sense because without anonymity, a lot of people would probably keep their mouth shut about things that need to be exposed that otherwise they would be afraid to do so.
Mm-hmm.
With that said, it's to me, it depends on the story and the severity of the story, but it almost feels like as someone who consumes a lot of media that it's just hearsay and then it gets an accusation, whether it's true or false, but when it gets into the mainstream and this locomotive starts running with it, you know, the allegedness turns into almost fact of matter, and people take it and it's, you know, it hasn't been proven. It's the same way in a court of law. When I step into in the court of law and someone is accusing a client of this atrocity or this crime, well, we can't really convict them if the source of information wants to remain anonymous and not even step in there. Now, you're talking about not even putting up a curtain to protect their identity. They're not willing to say it themselves, so it you don't know what to believe anymore.
Right. Lee, this is important because this is what I was asking Mei Ling about earlier, and that's the reporting that has to happen around right. The anonymous sources. Mei Ling?
Right. I mean, one of the things I tell even our beginning journalists, our aspiring reporters, is it is so essential. It always has been essential, their credibility, and they need to source things whenever possible, because at heart here is a challenge that our industry is facing right now, credibility issues. And the overuse of anonymous sources is a problem to that, because who knows where information is coming from. And that's speaking to, from a reader's point of view, the criticisms we have. And our president is playing off that skepticism of the public.
Dana, I was really happy when you had time to do the show today, because during the George W. Bush administration, you broke all these stories on the U.S.'s rendition program and secret prison sites. And I went back to read a series of those stories, and I saw that you were quoting many former intelligence agency sources and foreign officials. They were unnamed. This was a hugely consequential story. I'd like to know how you and your editors decided to publish such stories of consequence with a lot of sources that you could not name.
Well, in that case, we were also talking about a story that wasn't just controversial, but it was information that the government had classified, and therefore, you know, of a slightly more severe consequence potentially. And the government actually also asked us not to publish the story, and we engaged in conversation with them to try to determine why they believed, as they said they did, that some of these details would harm national security. So this is because we in the United States, the media is not under prior censorship. The government cannot censor us like actually it can in Britain if it's a national security issue, or in Israel. But the courts have protected us against that. That puts the responsibility on newspapers that obtain classified information through their reporting mechanism to make sure that they are not damaging national security, but are giving readers information they consider to be very important. And the way you do that is to try to talk with the government about their concerns, listen to their concerns, have other people brought into the conversation that can help you assess those concerns. But in the end, you still need to convince readers that what you're saying is accurate, even if you're not telling them who said it.
Right.
And the way that we did it in that story, those stories, and the way that good reporters still do it now is to give you details that would, as a reader, say, would lend more authenticity to a story. So back in the Black Site story, we didn't give exact locations, but we gave descriptions of the locations. And we tried to say where were these anonymous sources in terms of their position in the government? Why would they even know that? And so good reporting today does the same thing. In the story I just mentioned, it is according to top White House officials and outside advisors. So you get a sense that this very controversial scene within the White House, which is actually depicted with some detail, comes from people that were in there or who have talked to people that were in there. And so as a reader or as a reporter, I expect readers to be skeptical, and I need to be able to give them some details that will convince them that my sources have access to the information they're talking about.
And I think, Mei-Ling, this is another answer to what Lee called to ask with his question about hearsay. All this other reporting that Dana, yes, she might have had sources with an agenda, including to get this information out, but then all that other reporting fills in and verifies what those original sources were saying to her. Is that a fair way to put it?
Right. It's extensive verification, precision. Doing everything you can short of naming a source is essential.
Go ahead, Dana.
Well, I also wanted to weigh in on what Lee was talking about, mm-hmm. hearsay. And I think this is a huge problem in our industry now. It's especially a problem on television. Many of the quote-unquote news shows are really talk shows, and they have pundits who are giving their opinion. They are not always news journalists or straight journalists. So as a reader or a viewer, I listen for the words, "my sources say." If a person who's opining on a subject that they happen to have just read in the Washington Post and then, you know, the Huffington Post, which has basically taken the Washington Post and circulated it on their website and so on and so on, if someone is simply opining, well, I don't think that's good enough. And I think hosts should not be having people on whose sole purpose is just to give you their opinion of something, and they look like, purposely, they're trying to deceive in a way. They look like they actually did that reporting, and in fact, they didn't. And so I think viewers need to weigh in with media outlets, because media outlets actually do care about what readers and viewers say.
Call here from
right.
Bill. Mei-Ling, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, absolutely, and I think it is exacerbated by the fact, by the way that information travels and is shared. Mm-hmm. So we have the situation where we're not critical about who is giving information. We're not holding those talking heads, or et cetera, to a high standard. And it's easy to distribute that information and consume information without recognizing that those are not source information.
Nick says on Twitter, this is an issue now because it's being questioned by a man who constantly used, and I think he's talking about the president, "I heard" and "people are saying" as a staple of his disinformation campaign. But I will say, President Obama did not like the leaks that were coming out of his administration. He did a lot to pursue people that were leaking information. It isn't just President Trump who's upset about this. To the phones, to Bill in St. Paul. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Well, first off, I do read a lot of news outlets online and in paper form, and I am personally okay with anonymous sources.
Mm-hmm.
However, I guess ethically, as a journalist, when you have an administration and a government right now who is coming out against the use of anonymous sources, but then ethically as a journalist at the same time when the White House or the administration wants to get their story across but are using, you know, White House staff or White House sources without going on the record to get their viewpoint or their point across to the press, how should the press take that? Should they hold the administration and say, we're not going to post this or we're not going to put this out without having an administration official going on the record to get their viewpoint across where they are going against the use of anonymous sources in many cases or coming out against them?
Mei-Ling, how would you answer that?
Right. I think it's a long tradition, especially in Washington, D.C. I was a Washington correspondent for a while back when, and it's just an accepted practice among many organizations because of the back and forth between reporters in Washington. I think it's something that we have to look at, but I think that certainly there is no way that some of the information can come out without it being anonymous.
Dana, I mentioned the word agenda and sources a minute ago. Is it fair to say that as a journalist who's taking in this information that's coming to you out of leaked sources or anonymous sources, you do have to ask yourself, what's their agenda? That doesn't make them uncredible, but you are giving some thought to that.
Well, certainly. And mainly what you're worried about is whether their agenda is dominating their truth-telling. And so you do have to know from the get-go, and that's what makes actually today's news, the news that is happening in the Trump administration, so different, is because you have people, you have us as readers inside the White House, you know, almost simultaneously reporting things that are happening, you know, his calls to the Mexican president, his calls to the Australian prime minister that were very sensitive, given that this is an ally. You know, we heard about them the next day, or maybe right. It was even not even the next day. So those reporters have sources who are very close inside. And to me, this is the big difference. Every president wants to control the message, and they do that by instilling discipline in their ranks. George Bush did it fairly well in the beginning and then less well in the second term. Obama was very good at it. And he had fewer people breaking the rules. The Trump administration, it's kind of wild what is going on in terms of people's willingness to talk with the media about what is going on that day. And then, of course, the other big difference is not the president criticizing the media, because that presidents always do that. But it's what he's it's how he's criticizing them. It's not just leaking sensitive information he says shouldn't be out there. It is challenging the credibility of the media itself and calling us fake news. That is what the Russians do. It's what it's what the non-mainstream media is trying to say all the time. It's one thing to say that we may be lazy sometimes, we may be sloppy, we make mistakes, but in the main, you know, we are not fake news. We're not, and that's what's really different about his criticism of the media.
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, that is part of our media series through the summer, where we're examining some of the issues that the news media confronts, that news consumers confront, in, I think, as Dana just acknowledged, a rather unusual time. And we've asked Dana Priest, one of our guests this morning. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and a professor at University of Maryland, wrote for The Washington Post, still does, and Mei-Ling Hopgood with us, an associate professor of journalism at the Medill School at Northwestern, to give us some insight, draw back the veil a little bit on how newsrooms think about anonymous sources, how individual journalists deal with leaked information and anonymous sources, the processes that happen inside a newsroom, and then a lot of the pushback that we're getting right now from the president and others about the publications of stories that are not necessarily flattering, that they don't like. Questions about this, questions about the process, how journalists make decisions, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I want to get Kathy in here before the news break. Hey, Kathy, thanks so much for waiting.
Hi there, and I think this is a really important discussion, but what I'm hearing is also a lack of basic awareness and education. I think various media sources need to do some level setting with the public to explain to them what are all of the steps that we take as not just a journalist, but as the news source that's about to publish something. What criteria do we use? What steps do we take to go through and make sure that the sources are credible? We heard a lot about that in Watergate. We learned from All the President's Men, for example, what some of the steps were. The younger generations and I think people in general need some basic education so that we can tell news that's not credible from, okay, this news media outlet, we know exactly what they do to vet those sources.
Okay.
I think that would help us.
Well, can I jump in here?
Please do.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think some media organizations are doing just that. You can see it on the New York Times in discussion and behind the scenes of how they got the information, the documents, et cetera, in different stories that have come out. The Washington Post has done some of this. I think some big news organizations are revealing their processes in response to these sorts of criticisms, and I think it does help to some extent.
Dana, what would you say?
Well, I think Kathy has a great idea, and we all should do that. And in part, I have found talking to people like her that you know, people don't even understand, you know, the basics of how we do our job. And that's because we don't bother to tell them how we do our job. And for example, I'm not sure that everybody knows that anonymous sources are not anonymous to the reporters themselves. That's a huge
issue. People are confused about that, really.
They are confused about that. And so even the basics of how does a White House reporter do their job? How do they get to know these people? Well, you know, that is what they spend, you know, all their time doing is finding people who have been in the White House before, who are in the White House now, getting to know them, talking to them personally, face to face or over the phone, you know, perhaps on email, but developing a trust with individuals whose judgment they can come to rely on as being, you know, more or less accurate, so that when the moment comes for them to ask a certain question of them, they'll have some sense of who they interact with every day, what kind of information they would have access to, and generally what their credibility is by vetting it maybe with other people that they're getting to know as well. So it's a whole process. It's something that's very natural by the time anybody gets to be a White House correspondent at the Post. They know very well how to do all that. But I'm not sure the public knows how that happens. And I think it's an excellent idea to explain more about what we do.
We're going to get a look at the latest news. We're going to bring Barton Gellman, a reporter in who's done a lot of investigative work, including on the Edward Snowden story for The Post. Mei-Ling, can you stay or do you have to run?
I'm here.
Great. Good. I'd love to have you stay into the top of the hour, if that's good with you. And we'll continue our conversation here. More of your calls and your questions. If you're getting a busy signal, call us back. Reach me on Twitter. It's at Carrie, KerriMPR. To Phil Picardi now. And Phil, what are you leading with?
Hi, Carrie. President Trump's pick to lead the FBI is appearing at a confirmation hearing this morning. Christopher Wray is trying to convince senators on the panel he can operate independently of the White House. Wray's nomination came after Trump fired the former director, James Comey, amid an FBI investigation into Russian interference in the presidential election. Meanwhile, President Trump is defending his son, Donald Trump Jr., in regards to the Russia investigation. Writing on Twitter today, his son was open, transparent, and innocent in interviews yesterday. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says he is surprised Donald Trump Jr. is facing controversy for meeting with a Russian lawyer. At a news conference today in Brussels, Lavrov said he did not understand why the meeting, which Trump Jr. has acknowledged, has become such a large issue in the U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen is telling Congress the central bank expects to keep raising a key interest rate at a gradual pace and also plans to start trimming its massive bond holdings this year. In her semi-annual testimony on the economy, Yellen takes note of a number of encouraging factors she said should fuel economic growth over the next 2 years. And authorities say five people died in a fiery six-vehicle wreck that temporarily closed a stretch of Interstate 70 on the western edge of Kansas City yesterday. Authorities say the pileup started when a tractor-trailer hit a car, a sport utility vehicle, and then another tractor-trailer. All of the vehicles were engulfed in flames. Two other vehicles were found when authorities cleared the wreckage. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:36.
Later on All Things Considered, we'll pound the pavement on foot patrol with the Minneapolis Police Department. I'm Tom Cran. We'll have a new, old approach to policing, the latest on the Trump family's involvement with Russia, and all the day's news. Join me starting at 3.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11 on NPR News, how a new plaza in Rondo will beckon visitors from the very highway that destroyed the St. Paul neighborhood. Then we're rebroadcasting a report I produced in January from Ely, Minnesota, ahead of our live shows there on Thursday. Join us at 11.
Have you heard? I'm going to open the new season of Talking Volumes on September 14th. With Sherman Alexie. Yes, the incomparable Sherman Alexie. Amy Tan is on the list. Dan Brown, Ron Chernow, Jacqueline Woodson. We are so excited about this season of Talking Volumes. I hope I'll see you there. Tickets are on sale right now. You can call the Fitzgerald Theater box office or get them online. And I'll see you when we start in mid-September.
Support comes from Saturn System Software Engineering of Duluth, a domestic alternative to offshore and metro outsourcing, developing custom software solutions to solve complex business challenges. Offshore to the North Shore with Saturn Systems. More at SaturnSys.com.
Our conversation about the way journalists use anonymous sources and leaked information continues, and we're bringing Barton Gellman in now. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, and he reported on, among many stories, the Edward Snowden story for the Washington Post. And Barton, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
My pleasure.
I want to ask you about something that the CIA director Mike Pompeo told MSNBC last month. He thinks that the reason that there are so many leaks of classified information is because of Edward Snowden. And here's what he said. I think there's a phenomenon, the worship of Edward Snowden and those who steal American secrets for the purpose of self-aggrandizement or money or whatever their motivation may be does seem to be on the increase. Would you put the two together the way he is?
Only in a very attenuated way. First of all, he is throwing a lot of things together there to discredit the idea that there could be legitimate information provided to the public that was not official information from his agency or from another. So there is, for example, zero evidence and zero case that any of the sources have done it for money. He can characterize someone as wanting to do it for aggrandizement if he likes. But the fact is that, everyone in the system knows that there is rampant overclassification. B, we would know almost nothing to have a real debate about public policy and anything to do with foreign policy or national security if we relied only on the official statements of the government. We would have no idea about much of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I think there's actually a pretty basic test or a basic question that a news organization should ask itself when deciding about anonymous sources. It's an easy question to ask. It's sometimes hard to decide. But the principle is, what decision here will give maximum information of value to the public? Sometimes the fact that someone is trying to be anonymous when you tell them, I simply won't print it if it comes from the spokesman of the department anonymously, mm-hmm. When it's announcing official policy, you get more that way. Sometimes you get more that that people can only say if they have some protection, because there are Snowden cases in which someone believes that a disclosure is so important that he or she is willing to risk job, career, and even criminal prosecution. But there's a lot more we need to know that any given source is not going to say, I'm going to throw away my life for this.
You use the phrase, I think, maximum public value. Do I recall that right?
Yeah.
When you were talking about the assessment of how to use the information. I think we're in this age where there is so much distrust of public institutions, including the media, that news consumers don't necessarily believe that that is a key standard. What is the value to the public when you're it's going to sell paper. You know, you hear that all the time. I mean, they're going to make more money. There's a distrust that the media is doing this for the right reasons.
I think that's right. First of all, there is a lot more doubt about institutions in general. Some of it's justified. There was a lot of self-dealing by every institution and a lot of impunity by every institution in society. And newspapers are not immune, or news organizations are not immune from pressures. There is a lot of information out there and a lot of smart people who are holding us accountable. So if we slip up on a story, if we say something we can't stand behind, we're going to hear about it, and so is the public. And sometimes they'll hear more about that than they heard from the original story. But look, in your everyday life, when you care about something, you form a judgment pretty quickly, whether you can trust this person or that person. You've got a track record, or they're giving supporting information or not. If you're reading a book or a news article, you have an intuitive sense after a very little time of whether you trust the voice of the narrator. It's one of our built-in talents as humans, and we can hone that and pay attention to that. If we just want to say, to sort of reach for an easy conspiracy theory, you know, that's going to be hard to talk. If someone has that, it's going to be hard to talk them out of it. But I like your idea said earlier about showing your work.
Mei-Ling, would you speak to where the distrust of the media comes into this?
Well, I mean, I think I agree about the institutional distrust of our institutions at large. I think that we do have to think about the public and all the kinds of information they are looking at and consuming, and isolating the mainstream media organizations from the perspective of some of the public can be difficult. And that's obviously what we're talking about here. How can the public look at the different sources or the different media sources that they are consuming and say, is this information that I trust, instead of just, you know, looking at it at the last minute on your iPhone and believing it? I think that the public is pretty savvy, and it is not so true that there is a lot of ignorance among the public. I think a lot of the public does have this intuition.
Actually, can I add one quick thing here?
Sure.
My aim has always been to write for the persuadable middle about what the facts are. There is going to be a substantial slice of one's readership, viewership, that has already made its mind about the big questions and sees every fact as subsidiary to that. So they're simply not going to accept facts that don't fit their conception. But there are a lot of people, and they tend to be the swing element in society in terms of the way we make decisions as a polity or in the marketplace, who are open to information. And so it's fine if somebody wants to say everything is fake news. I actually don't think it's fine when a president says that. But let's just take the latest huge story, huge contribution by the New York Times. There are 3 days in a row. Mm-hmm. The first day, they rely entirely on anonymous sources to say that there is this email exchange involving Donald Trump Jr. and a meeting involving Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort. And they did that, I presume. Reporters are very good ones, because they couldn't get the story any other way. If they said, I will only write this if you give me your name, they would not have that story. I think it was an easy call to use anonymous sources. Within a day and a half, they have the full paper record to back up what they wrote, and every single thing that they got from anonymous sources, because they did a lot of checking, turned out to be not only true, but demonstrably true, and then admittedly true in the third version of the story that we got publicly from Donald Trump Jr. And so you look at that pattern as a reader, if you're open to the idea that we care about verifiable fact, there's a fantastic demonstration one day after another.
Call here from John in Minneapolis. Hi, John. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you, Carrie. Your shows are awesome.
Thank you.
So, like, what I'm called to think is, one, I just give a big thanks to all of these reporters that put their lives on the line, because it's a huge thing what they're doing so that we can get the information. And then when we look at Snowden, like, what did he have to gain by doing what he did? He's like almost a martyr to a certain degree. And with all of the noise of all the media and everything, these presidents, they know what they're doing. Look at how George Bush, he was able to shut up Dan Rather. I mean, this was it Dan Rather who got fired because he released those documents back in the day?
No, I think Dan Rather was part of a story for CBS News that was incorrect. And that's part of the reason he left CBS.
Fired.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but
so you look at how these people, I mean, I think what the people are trying to avoid is these types of dictators that shut up people. You know, look at Pinochet, what he did, Victor Jara, all of these different leaders that have been supported by evil forces. And, you know, here in America, we're blessed that we have the freedom of speech. But I just think that Trump is very savvy. I think all of the timing of everything that they've released is very savvy. And I think they're going to try to get what they can done in the next 4 years, and it's all going to be in favor of the oligarchs.
Dana, it sounded like you wanted to get in here.
Well, I absolutely agree that this is part of a pattern of trying to silence the media, either by discrediting us or worse, and especially since you talked about people putting their lives on the line. You know, most of us who report in Washington do nothing that brave, but our many colleagues overseas who are reporting from governments who are authoritarian, who use violence to silence people or imprisonment, that situation has grown to historic portions. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union nearly 30 years ago, the situation of the free media or the independent media and their ability to report about what is happening in their countries has never been worse, especially in, especially we should note in some of our countries, some of the countries that we say are our allies.
Mexico.
Well, Mexico, that's a little bit separate because it's mainly drug related. But I would point to Turkey and Egypt, where Turkey is now has one third of the world's imprisoned journalists in their prisons. They claim they're not journalists, they're terrorists, because they're associated with a spiritual movement that is very controversial, and that the president is wanting to shut down because it's a political challenge to him. And our country, which sometimes has successfully put pressure on other countries to do things by withholding arms, by withholding aid, that sort of thing, they have completely reversed that. And Donald Trump has embraced President Erdogan, who is doing this, and the same with Egypt. So the trend that we see here of intimidating the media in this more extreme way by calling our credibility and our foundation into question is happening in a very different way overseas. And as a global trend, this is a very worrisome thing. It is a fight between those in power and those who want to either question the moves of those in power or change the power structure. It is really a battle that we are engaged in, that people are engaged in, not just reporters, but societies are engaged in. The right to have information that is credible, and it's happening everywhere.
Mei-Ling, I threw Mexico in there, though, because I heard a statistic the other day that more journalists have died this year in Mexico reporting on, as Dana notes, the drug trade. But what she said about power and the battle, that is precisely what is happening in Mexico, and journalists are indeed putting their lives on the line to report on it.
Absolutely. And I was going to add to that that the tactics that the president is using in terms of attacking the credibility, calling fake news, that is happening in many countries all over the world. I was just going to say in Argentina, you saw a lot of that kind of those accusations from the former president there. I mean, you will see it in many places. So these are And of course, as you mentioned, Mexico and the more violent tactics. So it is something that's happening worldwide.
Barton, I was reading something that Michael Gerson wrote recently in the Post about why there are so many leaks coming out of the president's own administration and high up in his staff. And Gerson says the moral tone of the executive office of the president is set by the president, and this one is morally stunted. In Trump's house of betrayal, leaks must seem the normal way of doing business. And leaks against the president probably come from officials reaching the limits of their patience with dysfunction. Does that, for you, explain part of the reason why there are so many leaks coming from the Times and the Post and other news organizations?
Sure. There are always many explanations for leaks. There's a game people like to play when they read anonymous source said this. It must have been this person or that person. It must have been in order. They guess the identity and they guess the motive. If you know the motive of the leaker as a reader, you have some chance of guessing the kind of source it was. If you know the kind of source it was, you can guess the motive. If you know neither, my experience is that people guess wildly wrong. But right now, it's not just a limit of patience inside the administration. There's a real sense of disbelief and fear, even among the president's closest people. There are people very close to the president, and that's all I can say, who are calling reporters all the time. And when reporters say, this looks kind of crazy and disorganized over there, these people will say, you have no idea. It's so much worse than you can imagine from the outside.
Wow.
If you have a president who spends most of his day either watching TV, tweeting about TV, or yelling at people inside the White House about TV, you're gonna scare the other inhabitants. And he called a group of congressmen and women into the Oval Office to talk about one thing. He sat at his desk. They stood because it was a large group. And for most of the scheduled hour, he was declaiming against Morning Joe and Mika Brzezinski. And that, there are people who come out of that and say, I'm scared. I don't know what's happening here, but, people need to know it.
I mean, the other thing, Dana, that as Barton describes, the inside knowledge of what happens in some of these meetings, you think about the implications of that meeting with Lavrov and I think one other official in the Oval Office where the president called Comey a nut job. Now, how many people were in that room? I mean, the fact that that kind of explicit information gets out so quickly, what does that say?
Well, it does say that people are worried to a level that is just unprecedented. I mean, our world is not safe. There are things going on all around us. The people in the White House, including his very close staff, are seeing the highest kind of classified information that is telling you how dangerous the world is and how complicated these alliances are just to keep together. And they know that there is so much work they should be doing and that the president's attention should be focused on these matters of great consequence. And yet, just as a matter of how he spends his time, it is not being done. The agencies of government are run by and large by professionals, and they honestly might have their personal view of who should or shouldn't be president, but they really would be willing to work for whichever party. What they're very worried about now is that the wheels of government have stopped. not only because the president's not paying attention to what government does, but also because the people around him that are supposed to be giving direction, strategic guidance, but also leadership, they are consumed by this. And the, as we know, the second level staff has not even been appointed to help these agencies who are, you know, who are given billions of dollars a year to do important things. They have not been appointed to have them do these things. So it's, you know, it's challenging to the mechanism of government and the loyalty of people who spend their whole lives toiling in it.
I want to grab Gary here in St. Paul. Hey, Gary, thanks so much for waiting. Tell me what you're thinking about as you listen to this.
I'm getting more disgusted every day with this news media crap. Why are you so afraid to say anything about Trump? Before the election, he made statements, it's on tape, collusion with Russia to knock down Hillary as a candidate. And it's his own words, it's on tape, yet they don't bring that up at all. You don't bring that up at all.
So Gary, just so I understand, you're saying why aren't the claims that the president has made against Hillary Clinton and emails and those kinds of things, you're saying why hasn't the media investigated that?
Why haven't they? And why haven't they jumped on it? This guy just gets away with me.
Gary, I'm tight on time. I'm going to ask Barton and maybe May Ling to weigh in on this. Barton, what would be the answer to Gary on this?
Well, I understand the frustration. I would respectfully ask the caller, or ask Gary, how do you think you know that this happened? You know this happened because it got wall-to-wall 24-hour coverage of what Trump said. Every news organization practically, including many that never had it before, stood up fact-checking operations. The Trump invitation to Russia to please supply the 30,000 emails, which he made in public and then called a joke, has been brought back up again many, many times in the stories that have happened in the last 3 days. So I would just respectfully disagree. There are people who want us somehow to smite him, to bring it up in a way that shames him out of so that he stops saying it or somehow forces him to admit the truth. And those ambitions are not within our purview.
And May Ling, I have to say, I think Hillary Clinton would argue that she has been investigated one way and the other. I mean, she's felt that she was under assault from the news media, too. I have about 45 seconds here.
Right. I mean, all these leaders always feel like they're under assault from the media. I mean, in part, questioning what they do and say and their behaviors is our job. And what I'd say about the caller, I would totally agree that there has been extensive coverage from a reader standpoint or a viewer standpoint, a consumer standpoint. There's so much information. Again, it's easy to have the perception that the media is not covering things.
And that's where I'm afraid that's where I have to leave it. May Ling, right. Barton, Dana, thank you so much. Really good to have you on the show. Appreciate your insight on this.
Thank you.
Okay.